Blog Talk Radio.
It's time for Driving Me Crazy, coming to you live from Beechtree Studios near beautiful Pinehurst, North Carolina. This is the only show where a husband and wife drive, talk cars and life, and still love one another each day. Here's John and Laurie. Or is it Laurie and John? Oh, take it away, you crazy kids.
Actually, it's Hezzy, as I'm trying to bring in Laurie and John, who are patiently waiting. We had some technical difficulties, and I just completely lost track of the time. So bear with me a moment as we try to bring them in. Seems there are technical difficulties, which I didn't expect, but that was not the reason for the delay. Thankfully, Laurie, in a sense, practically woke me up and said, hey, is there a technical difficulty? And there was, which I had not noticed. Oh, goodness. So let's just see if we can bring them in. Trying to get them. Bear with me a second here. Let me see if there's another way to get this done. One moment here. Okay, one moment. I'm trying to see if this is going to work. Yeah, this might work. Okay, well, I'm going to ask them to hang up because they've been holding on for almost 11 minutes now. Hopefully they will. In the meantime, I'm going to try to ring them up from our end. So hopefully that'll work. And if it doesn't work, then there are really major, major difficulties here. So let's just quickly see. I'm going to see if this will work.
Hello.
Okay, I'm not. Hello, how are you?
I'm here. Are you there?
Yes, I am. I'm here. I'm sorry for the hiccup. Evidently, there were problems, but that was not the cause of this issue. There were problems, evidently, because it took me a while, even since you called me up, that there were problems, and I don't know what the problems were. But anyway, we're back on, so we're going to be talking about the Kona today, which is very exciting.
Well, if there was any, this is very, very sad for me to tell you, Hezzy, but if there was ever a show where being 8 minutes short in time is good, and please forgive me, but it's this show, and here's why. As our regular listeners know, Johnny and I are probably Hyundai's top cheerleaders in the entire automotive press corps. We love Hyundai. Hyundai is fantastic, the most bang for your buck. But I'm afraid that with the Hyundai Kona N, it fell a little short of the mark from me. So in the review that you will listen
to. I'm totally destroyed.
I was destroyed early on to the point where when we first got the car last week and Johnny got behind the wheel and I got into the passenger seat, after a very short time, I said to him, here's your car for the week. I'm not driving it. And I've only ever said that about a handful of cars in my 35 years of reviewing cars. But Hyundai, we love you. You are the most bang for the buck, but I'm afraid, my dears, this time you fell short. So when you read our review in the Yonkers Tribune, you'll see why. But I'm going to just speak very briefly because Johnny actually has many good things to say about this car, but I actually never drove it. So here's what I will tell you. This is yet again, and Hyundai is not guilty alone of this. This is another car where the manufacturers figure they can satisfy a young family where the father is kind of still in the race car mode, wishes he had something racy to drive around, and the young mother has one or two kids sitting in the back seat and needs to go grocery shopping and to play group. So what it is a marriage of a race car with a family car, a four-door family sedan, and I have not seen one vehicle by any of the manufacturers that has yet to not miss the mark. It's like marrying an elephant with a poodle. It doesn't work. And so for that reason, So for that reason, what happens is the big noise value that a race car has makes this, as the family car or the couple sedan, very noisy. The big value of having, you know, paddles and being able to control the car means you're going to get a bumpy ride. As the, on the family aspect of it, it's too much to juggle in two in one machine. So for that reason, I'm now going to pass this review over to my wonderful husband, who, by the way, this morning and reached his goal of 199.2 pounds, having started his journey not that long ago at 248. He's done it. Cheers. Balloons coming out of the ceiling. Fireworks. I'm so proud of him, and he looks wonderful. But he has no acetal. So here's Johnny, and take it away. And here we go.
Thank you, dear.
Well, thank you, Johnny, for doing what you've done. You know, I may have been a little bit ahead of you when it came to losing weight.
Aren't you down to 165 or some such thing?
Yeah, I'm down to 165.
Oh, my gosh. How tall are you?
Last time I checked, this was many years ago, I was 6'2", but I'm probably a lot shorter now. You know,
I'm
73 in another week and a half.
Wow. Good for you. Well, anyway, you usually lose about an inch over the years, so you're probably still 6'1". My gosh, 6'1 at 165 is, like, incredible. In my youth, I
ended up buying a pair of jeans, a skinny jeans. I couldn't believe I actually fit into it.
I know my belt is now up to like the last loop. It's never been there before, I'll tell you. So
I'm actually the same way like you. I've got no more holes.
Yeah. Well, that's a good, you know, actually it's a good problem to have. I've had some health issues over the years, and I'm sure losing weight is something that
it helps.
We all eventually, if you are overweight, you eventually come to the realization, if you have any sense at all, that, hey, this isn't doing me any good. I probably need to do something different. And it's not easy. I'll be the first to say that losing weight, especially because I'm 74, and losing weight at our age is not an easy thing. You have routines and things that you like and things that you enjoy that probably aren't that good for you. Like ice cream and some other things, and wine. You know, you just have to evaluate where you are health-wise. And Lord knows, I don't know about you. Well, I'm pretty sure you're in the same boat. I take a handful of pills every morning, a handful of pills every evening.
Oh, are you kidding? A fortune of pills. It's
absolutely
unbelievable.
You know what
the secret is, though, John, and that is that when I was told never to get old, I guess I didn't listen. And evidently, that should have been a big bell that went off, but I just never followed instructions.
Well, we got older, so, but we kept living like we were young people. Yeah, that's what happens. I think you're right.
Yeah. So
well,
maybe
anyway,
I'm getting wiser in my old age.
I don't know that I could have gotten a lot stupider. So, I mean, it's got to be going correctly by this point in life, I think. But anyway, to talk a few minutes about the Kona.
The Kona.
The Kona. And I, like Lori said, we've been big proponents of Hyundai. And I remember getting the first one, and there were problems with it, and I'm thinking, oh, my God. And then we've done shows where we talked about how far they'd come in just a few years and how they had tried to do things that really appealed to the American populace and had been very successful at it, in my opinion. And the outgrowth of that was the Genesis, if you remember, which was kind of the really high end. And it's been a beautiful car. Well, the Kona is sort of a I forget the racing movie. Do you remember the racing movie that the guy passed away? the Fast and the Furious. That was the name. You remember the Fast and the Furious? And they had these little cars.
I remember the name, but I didn't see.
Yeah,
the
and
movie.
they'd put nitrous oxide or whatever on the engines, and they had computers in the seat next to them, and they would program all this, and the little car would just like jump down the track and be doing 100 miles an hour, and it was all that kind of thing. And it had a big following, and people began to get those kinds of cars and do some of those kinds of things to them. Well, the Kona N, at least this one, sort of harkened back to those days. It's got this, and I think Lori put a picture, which I hope appears in there, but it shows a big red button just at the bottom right of the steering wheel, and it just says NGS on the button. Well, if you research, because I just generally don't push buttons to see what happens. I really kind of like to know,
right.
Especially a big red one, which usually means you're going to be ejected out of the driver's seat or something. So I looked it up. And what happens when you look it up, and I think I even gave the link to it, you get to a video, and the video shows you about, it's called launch control. Now, think about that, launch control. And it's about the steps you go through, putting the car in park, I think it is, stepping on the brake pedal, stepping on the gas, pushing some buttons in the console, and eventually you push this NGS button, which stands for N Grin Shift, whatever that means. Anyway, so you push that button. Then when you start out, you take your foot off the brake, and I think you leave your foot on the gas, and it basically launches the car. And it says in the video that this is racetrack. This is a racetrack mode. You get set up on the racetrack, you do all these things, and you're ready. And then when you take your foot off the brake, zoom, it is in race car mode. And so it's designed to be a little road-hugging, incredibly fast vehicle from that standpoint. And also the video says, well, you can't just put it in and out of this. You have to, you know, let up, and then you drive, I think, 2 minutes or something, or 7 minutes or whatever, for it to recycle and reset itself.
Uh-huh.
It's not something that you just do. It is a real feature. It is a real feature to make the car a race car. Well, because I'm 74, and Lori and I review cars from the standpoint of, you know, what do people like? Not necessarily our age, but at least, you know, kind of middle-aged and older. What are they looking for in cars, and how does this fit? The Kona N is a young person's car. At least I think it is. At least I'm not in the race mode at 74. Maybe at 50 I might still have been. I don't know. So I can't just say blanketly that it's not for everybody, but I know that it seems to me anyway that it's more geared for the young married couple. Let's say they're 21 to, and they can't afford a big car or don't want a truck, or they live in the city, and so they want something that's relatively economical. This is was $37,000, I think. It says on what I wrote up. But anyway, let's say it's $37,000, which is not cheap, but is probably affordable by most couples that are working, or if the husband's doing pretty good. And they have maybe one child, a little child, somebody that can go in the back seat, doesn't take up a lot of room, uses child seats, all that kind of thing. And so the husband then can still hang on to his youth. He has this little race car thing that he can zip around, maybe go outside of town or whatever, street race, I don't know. And then the wife, the mother, has a little vehicle that she can run to the store in. It has enough room behind the seats with both seats up for probably 4 or 5 bags of groceries, which is good.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you put a seat down, you'd have more room. And it gets 20, I think it averages 23 miles a gallon. It's supposed to get 27 on the road, 20 around town, and it averages 23. It averaged 23 miles per gallon the whole time we had it. So that 23 okay. miles a gallon seems pretty accurate. Not that that's exceptional, but it's not bad. And so if you are the kind of family who would want a smaller vehicle, probably affordable, has kind of a racing element to it that makes you feel good about, I can still zip around and hug the corners and all that, but yet supports the wife and having a child and shopping and going out to eat. And it looks good. I mean, their cars always look good. Mm-hmm. Then this is an okay car from that standpoint. A couple of things about the car, again, as Lori talked about, that really sort of bothered me was, and you know, cars, remember when we talked about cars that were made, and if it was made on a Thursday or a Friday, I don't remember. Remember when we talked to
you? Right. Yeah, I remember.
Theory
that
mm-hmm. yeah, if you make cars on a Thursday or Friday, there's always a few lemons because people are trying to get out mm-hmm. of work and so on. They're just not paying attention.
Yeah.
Well, and I don't know whether maybe this is still the case, but in this particular Kona, this one that we drove, when in the morning when I'd start it up and we park outside our condo here, and so I would mm-hmm. back up, and then I make a left hand, have to make a full left hand turn to sort of turn the car around to go out of the area. Well, when I back up, everything fine, put it in drive, and turn the steering wheel to the left. And when you turn to the left, you would get this thumping sound, and it seemed to be coming from the right front tire. In the old days, and this is where a lot of people even remember, but there was this thing about wheel bearings, and you had to get your wheel bearings replaced every now and then. And the key to knowing when your wheel bearings were wearing is because there would be a thumping in generally wherever the mm-hmm. tire was, there would be a thumping because the bearings would wear out. Well, this car's too new. It's only got 4,000 miles on it. It's too new to have the bearings wearing out. Might be a problem with wheel bearings. I don't know. Or because it's set up with 19-inch wheels, which are a little bit bigger than the typical wheels they have on here, which I think are 18-inch, mm-hmm. I don't know but what the tire on the right side, and I didn't never had to go, you know, make a right-hand turn and see if it did on the left, but I don't know whether maybe the tire was hitting the wheel well, you know, which is a possibility uh-huh. inside of there. I don't know if that was the case or not. But I do know that it's something I believe Hyundai, if they ever see this report or ever see our review, it's something they ought to look into. They ought to, and you would think that they would have tested all those kinds of things. I don't know. Might have been a problem with the vehicle. Might have been a problem with the wheel size. Might have been a problem with the wheel well. Maybe the wheel wells are a little mm-hmm. too small. Or maybe there's a dent in the wheel well or it's bulging somewhere and it's hitting. I don't know. But I do know that it wasn't 100% correct. I didn't. Once I started driving it, no thumping sounds, nothing like that. No problem going in and out of parking lots, right-hand turns, left-hand yeah. turns, parking back in. None of those problems. So it went away once I got going, which tends to make me think it was something about tire size and the wheel well. Again, I'm not an engineer, but I would hope that Hyundai would look at that. That's one thing. The second thing that really sort of, I don't know, I found discomforting was I got in that vehicle, and it sits low to the ground, of course, and the seats, for me anyway, were very comfortable. They had a little kind of a bolster on each side that had a little flare.
Right.
Not enough to hurt me when I got into the vehicle. It did mm-hmm. seem to help keep you stable and in the middle of the seat, all that kind of thing.
Okay.
But when I started driving the car, you could feel literally every little bump in the road.
Wow.
And so it was like driving a sports car, and I've owned sports cars, which are meant to feel the road so that you sort of know, kind of you feel the road so you know when you're going into a turn, you can evaluate, you know, how fast, how mm-hmm. slow, what you need to do, some of those kinds of things. But and so it's important that you feel the road. And, of course, we're used to driving. Lori's got the Cadillac now. And when you drive the Cadillac, you don't feel the road. I can tell you that, you know, great lover of Cadillacs. But But this one is a sports car. It's a sports car mentality. So you feel every bump in the road, even if the road is smooth. And when you get off-road, not in the deep woods, but there's some sandy roads here that we go on to go to visit some people.
Right.
And the sandy road, I mean, you are bouncing around in the seat, even going very slowly, which you do on sand roads, but even 10, 15 miles an hour, you're sort of getting bumped around. It's very strong suspension, which is very good for racing, but not very good for just driving around. So if a young family bought this and they lived in the city, it'd probably be okay. But if a young family bought this and they lived in the country, I think they would get tired of the ride relatively quickly because it's not comforting. It's not a comforting ride. And it isn't something that I would want to drive for long periods of time. Even 4 hours, I think, would wear you out because, you know, it's just the suspension and the sort of the feeling that you're getting
from the road
off. Can I ask you,
though, you know, yep. I'm hearing what you're saying, but when you buy a car, how do you learn all of this? I mean, you experienced it, so you know how it felt and how the car reacted and it, you know, the relationship that you were able to, I guess, analyze when you were driving the car. How does a consumer know the difference? Because I would never even think to go that far, or that maybe there's something wrong with the way they melded these two concepts, you know, taking care of mom and the kids and taking care of a husband that still feels that he's 25 years old and needs to go racing down the street. I don't know.
Well,
it's a difficult marriage.
It is, but you have to remember, too, and I think I'm going to answer two parts to that question. But
yeah.
The first part is I think the car manufacturers are trying to cross over into the more people they can attract to a particular model because there's such a competition that if you're not
right.
selling the models, you're going to cancel them. I mean, that's baseline. The second thing is, you know, how does a consumer get to know this? First of all, there's a couple of things that are kind of self-explanatory, and that is, if you're going to buy a vehicle, you want to go somewhere and drive the vehicle. Whether it's that vehicle that you purchase or a vehicle like that one, maybe a different color, maybe with some different things on it that you'd want as a personal car, if you could order it and you might have to wait a year to get it or 6 months or whatever the time is now because of all the problems we know with manufacturing. But you should go and drive the vehicle. And I don't mean up and down the street. You put the guy who's selling you the car in the car, and you go driving. And you drive fast. You drive slow. You go, not off-road, but you go into neighborhoods. You do some really, you know, sharp left-hand turns into a driveway, and you back out and all that. And you get if you did that with the car that we're talking about, and it did any of those things like the thumping in the front wheel well, or you didn't like the ride, you wouldn't buy that car. You see what I'm saying?
Exactly.
All right, that's
but most
one part.
People don't do that, do they? Most
I don't know.
Don't
I would hope they would. I've never
I would
bought
hope
a car
they
that
would
I
too.
I've never bought a car that I didn't drive and check out to some
right.
even used ones. And the second thing is, and I don't know unless they've changed this, there used to be a 48-hour rule, and the 48-hour rule was if you buy a car and you drive it off the lot and within 2 days, if you have a problem with the car or whatever and you don't like it, you can return it. Now, that's what it used to be. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know whether it's that way anymore. But that was exactly for what we're talking about. You take it for a test drive. It's great. You go down and you either get a mortgage or you get the cash and you take it up and buy the car. And then you drive it off and the next day you find out this doesn't work or that doesn't work or there's something wrong with the transmission or the engine has some strange sounds. You could take it back and say, no, this isn't working. I want my money back or I want a different car.
Mm-hmm.
And they would always work with you on those kinds of things. But now that was a long time ago. Remember, we don't buy very many cars anymore. Lori's Cadillac was the most recent purchase. So,
right.
But anyway, that's. I guess I've gone over time now, but that was.
No, you're fine.
We still love Hyundais. I still love Hyundais. I'm telling you, I've seen them grow, and so many of the things. And of course, I couldn't leave this, if you'll let me, without a reference to the safety aspect. This is something I will always be in admiration of about Hyundais. They were the first ones that had the commercials, 5 cars in a line, 4 people climb out the roof of their vehicle and jump on a truck next to
them. I remember.
And to this day, that was the best commercial regarding safety. The front car stops and every car behind it stops at a safe distance. I just thought and still to this day think that was absolutely brilliant. Anyway, when it comes to safety, you look at this car, and it has virtually everything. It has, now they have bumpers that has 2.5 mile per hour bumpers. That means if you bump into something at 2.5 miles per hour or less, it doesn't hurt the car. It doesn't make
That's
any
great.
Difference. Yeah, and it's got the, you know, it tells you if you should or should not exit. It's monitoring the cars in front of you. It's monitoring where you are in the lane. It's telling you if you should take a break. I know I drove it for a while, and the little thing come up and said, maybe you should take a break and have some coffee or something. I wasn't sleeping or that kind of thing, but it had just been enough time in the vehicle that it said those kinds of things. And it pays attention to your driving. And it just, there's so much to keep you out of an accident that it really is wonderful from that standpoint. Plus, they got this great guarantee on their car, 100,000 miles and all those kinds of things. So even if you do have problems, they're going to do their best to fix it. Again, huge supporter of Hyundais, no matter what the model. But I did have a few concerns about this particular Kona N. Okay?
Well, it might be very interesting because you found some issues that reveal themselves in the driving, in the test drive. Maybe that's something that needs to be told to the distributor that sent you the car.
They get our reviews.
Okay. Then that's perfect because then Hyundai will get it.
Yeah. All right. And the last thing I wanted to say is this next week we will be reviewing the Buick 2023 Envision Essence all-wheel drive. And I can tell you it looks like a great car.
I can't wait for that.
Oh, yeah, I'm looking forward to driving it.
It's a beautiful car. I'm really quite excited about Buick because they've really evolved quite a bit.
Yes,
sir. At one time I thought they were staid, but now they're really on par.
Yep.
It's absolutely wonderful. Maybe General Motors is doing a good job.
Like all the car companies, they're realizing they're going to have to and they're going to have to provide what people want. Look at what the foreign car manufacturers have done in this country. I mean, it's pretty incredible when you think about it. In Americans, how many Americans buy American cars and how many Americans buy foreign cars? If I said to you, you know, what's the best luxury car out there? There's a good chance you're going to say Mercedes or BMW. These are not American cars. You know, so
that's right. So
the U.S. manufacturers have their job cut out for them to make people happy.
Well, they are really sprucing everything up. I hear the new Corvette is like the fastest thing going, and I think that, you know, American manufacturing, no matter which brand it was, has languished for a long time. And
absolutely.
I think they're starting to find their stride again. And I think that's wonderful because there's a different feel to an American vehicle.
Right.
And I think we need to get back to that platform on a much higher level than we used to be.
I'm with you. That we've forgotten how to be.
But I think that's great. Well, I'm excited, John. What a pleasure. And my apology again to you and Lori for being so delayed today. I just lost track of time. No problem, my friend.
Keep
doing what you're doing because, you know, we're going to have to get together and enjoy a good meal that's very healthy for both of us and maybe we'll lose another half a pound.
I'd like that.
All the best.
All right,
thank
buddy.
So
talk
much,
to you next week.
Don.
Thank you.
Be well.
Bye.
Bye. Oh, how exciting. Does it ever get any better than John Weil and Lori Weil? I don't think so. I just love them to death. They are wonderful, wonderful people. And it's so exciting to always talk to them. So on target, so honest about everything that they do. Just very, very exceptional people. And you don't bump into people like that too often. I've met Lori when she was in New York, and but I never met John. Johnny Weil. But he seems to be like, I don't know, it's like this long lost relative that I haven't seen yet. But I'm gonna have to get this thing done. I'm getting too old before it gets too old. Before I get too old to be able to travel and go see them. So that will be cool. Anyway, while we're at it here today, let's do a couple of other things, and hopefully you'll find that interesting as well. And we'll cover quite a bit of news today. This is really very, very exciting. And it turns out that the German parliament has recognized the Yazidi genocide in Iraq. This is something I had not expected at all. This is a story. It seems as the German Bundestag, that's their parliament, recognized the massacre of Yazidis by jihadists from the so-called Islamic State in Iraq as, quote, genocide, end quote. The Germany's lower house of parliament, the Bundestag, recognized on Thursday the 2014 massacre of Yazidis by the Islamic State group jihadists in Iraq as a genocide and called for measure to assist the besieged minority. In a move hailed by Yazidi community representatives, deputies in the Bundestag passed the motion by the three parliamentary groups in Germany that are ruling the center-left-led coalition and conservative members of parliament. The Bundestag, quote, recognizes the crimes against the Yazidi community as genocide following the legal evaluations of investigators from the United Nations, the resolution said, after similar moves by countries including Australia, Belgium, and the Netherlands. Well, the resolution condemns indescribable atrocities and, quote, tyrannical injustice, end quote, carried out by Islamic State fighters, quote, with the intention of completely wiping out the Yazidi community, end quote. Well, the motion urges the German judicial system to pursue further criminal cases against suspects in Germany and the government to increase financial support to collect evidence of crimes in Iraq and boost funding to help rebuild shattered Yazidi communities. It also calls for Germany to establish a documentation center for crimes against Yazidis to ensure a historical record and to press Baghdad to protect the minority group's rights. Extremist militant group seized the Sinjar Mountains in northern Iraq, where Yazidis have lived for centuries. That was back in 2014. The Yazidis follow an ancient religion rooted in Zoroastrianism, which Islamic State considers heresy. The jihadists forced women and girls into slavery, recruited boys as child soldiers, and killed many of the community's men. And since then, thousands of Yazidis have fled the region. Around 5,000 people are believed to have been killed and another 7,000 people kidnapped. Many were taken to areas of Syria where Islamic State held territory at the time. Unbelievable. But thank God, with Germany recognizing and declaring that the Yazidis were had fallen into being killed genocidally in Iraq, really, really is going to be a very, very powerful message around the world. So it's going to really be terrific, and it's going to make a big difference, that's for sure. Now, one second, I want to just check this out. Okay, I want to go into what's happening in Lebanon since we're already in the Middle East. Seems that Lebanon's middle class is vanishing as the economy collapses. Following years of political and economic crises, Lebanon's population structure has changed, and not for the better. Experts believe that the structural inequality will only widen in future. Lebanon's capital of Beirut has turned into a city of contrasts. Expensive cars parked before popular restaurants and bars, while people of all ages rummage through bins for something edible. Also, more and more people are begging in the streets, mainly children, but also elderly people. Anna Fleischer, she's the head of the German Heinrich Böll Foundation's office in Beirut, advised Deutsche Welle, while it is hard to tell the nationality, quote, it can be assumed that there are many Syrian refugees, but also Lebanese, she added. Years of political instability in combination with the ongoing economic crisis, exacerbated by the COVID-19 pandemic and the port of Beirut blast in August of 2020, have brought the country close to collapse. Lebanon ranks not only, quote, among the most severe crises globally since the mid-19th century, according to the World Bank, but it is also likely an, quote, unprecedented institutional vacuum with further, which will further delay any agreement on crisis resolution and critical reform ratification, deepening the woes of the Lebanese people, the World Bank report had said. Well, following years of massive economic contraction, in combination with a 95% devaluation of its currency, the Lebanese middle class has practically vanished. In fact, in March of 2020, the World Bank devalued Lebanon to a lower middle income country. A person that's earning 1,500,000 Lebanese pounds used to have an equivalent of about $1,000 before the crisis. And now it is equivalent to less than $200, Hussein Chiatu, a development economist at the Policy Initiative, a Beirut-based research center, advised. In a recent publication on rising hunger and poverty in Lebanon by Human Rights Watch, HRW, Lena Simet stated that, quote, millions of people in Beirut, in Lebanon, have been pushed into poverty and have cut back on food. A senior economic justice researcher at HRW pointed to worrying trends of food insecurity and the lowest bracket of earners. Well, similarly, in September, a report on food insecurity in the Middle East by the independent research network Arab Barometer found that nearly half of all citizens in Lebanon stated that they ran out of food before they had money to buy more. Well, meanwhile, there are no indications for change, and the tax system is not helping the overall situation in Lebanon. The taxation system in Lebanon is highly regressive, which means that there is no wealth tax code, and corporate taxes are amongst the lowest in the world compared to all OECD averages. Well, the beneficiaries of the taxation system are those of the political class and their business connections, because this 1% owns more than 70% of the national income, Chiaito had said. This in turn leaves a very small percentage of wealth to the rest of the society, he claims. Furthermore, those who earn their wages in Lebanese pounds or receive support via charity organizations suffer another disadvantage. Banks only offer limited cash withdrawals in U.S. dollars to those who have U.S. dollars in their accounts. Also, For the past 20 years, Lebanese banks have kept a pegged exchange rate of $1 to 1,500 Lebanese pounds. This, however, may be updated to $1 to 15,000 pounds on February 1. Even though this is 10 times more than before, it is still far from the actually being used exchange rate on the black market. The current rate is 50,000 pounds to the dollar. So can you imagine? Unbelievable. Even less than one-third the value of what's being given on the black market. On the other hand, for those who work for international companies or have other means of accessing dollars, life has become relatively cheap, which also explains the thriving cocktail bars and fully booked restaurants. Well, the reality today is that one of the most important sources of income for families are remittances from family members who live abroad. Lynn Zovigian, the co-founder and managing director of Zovigian Partnership, a family-owned social investment platform that develops research-led socioeconomic interventions. Well, the collapsed private sector and expected contraction of the public sector is driving rising unemployment numbers, she said, adding that Lebanon is also going through a de facto dollarization of its economy, but not by law or policy. This is happening with no price controls or penalties against financial abuse, the Beirut-based Zovigian had said. Meanwhile, talks between the Lebanese government and the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, have led to a staff-level agreement for a program worth about $3 billion over the next 46 months. However, a financial recovery plan to protect the most vulnerable in society was not included. $3 billion will be barely enough to get the country back on its feet, given the size of the losses in the financial sector, which are at least $70 billion, Saeto said. Moreover, the International Monetary Fund agreement highlighted that, given the weak state of the Lebanese government and the public sector, Lebanon should focus on state-owned enterprises and the privatization of social and public services, Chiato had said. What are the guarantees that private companies won't actually engage in price hikes and further inflation, which we've seen in Latin America? This could mean that only the ultra-rich will be able to access services, end quote, the analyst had said. He regards macroeconomic stabilization as the only solution to save the country from collapse, and with it, the majority of the population. I refer to the redistribution of losses in the financial sector, ensuring that we have to clear financial recovery plan that primarily protects the smallest of depositors and people who have a middle or low income, Hussein Chayeto had said, adding that, quote, their wealth has to be recapitalized. Without this, it will be impossible to really see the income gap being reduced, end quote. So this is the problem, a major, major problem. Also, another ancillary aspect of what's going on. There's a fuel shortage which plunges Lebanon into darkness. Lebanon's two largest power stations were shut down after running out of fuel. Officials say the outage will last several days. It is the latest hardship for people in Lebanon, where many are in poverty due to soaring prices and record unemployment. So these are some of the other issues. It's unbelievable. Literally unbelievable. Oh, God. All right, let's just look at something else in Latin America. It seems that Africa is betting on Brazil's new president, Lula da Silva. Many African leaders were quick to congratulate Brazil's president, Lula da Silva, on his election. They are counting on da Silva to improve relations, which had greatly suffered under former President Jair Bolsonaro. Africa will again be a priority in Brazil's relationship with the world, stated Brazilian President Inácio Lula da Silva after meeting his counterpart from Guinea-Bissau, Umaro Sissoko Embalo, in early January. Lula da Silva's last two terms of office from 2003 to 2010 left happy memories in Africa. He traveled to more than 30 African nations and opened embassies in 19 countries. Former President Jair Bolsonaro, however, did not visit the continent even once, expressing his lack of interest in Africa. Quote, I think we'll get back to the original Lula strategy of a closer relationship with Africa and much more closer relations again with South Africa and BRICS. William Gumede, the chairperson of the South Africa-based Democracy Works Foundation, advised. Well, the BRICS, the group of emerging economies comprised of Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, originally a ruse formation to push economic ties, has increasingly turned into a political force. Brazil's more determined stand against Russia's war of aggression in Ukraine will also counteract what Gumede describes as South Africa's quite bad situation of totally sitting on the fence, actually defending, not criticizing Russia publicly, end quote. But closer ties with Africa are very much Brazil's interest. Quote, as big as Brazil is, it is still a developing economy. The African issues are also Brazilian issues, Gumede had said. Quote, for instance, fair trade and access to world markets, for which global institutions such as Bretton Woods or the World Trade Organization have to be reformed, end quote. Well, Brazilian policies under Lula da Silva led to a six-fold increase in trade with Africa during his first two terms. But Brazilian interest in Africa started to wane under his successors Dilma Rousseff and Michel Temer due to global economic turmoil and political crises at home. Under Bolsonaro, Africa disappeared from Brazilian politics. Analysts warned that Africa not to place too much hope on economic aid from Brazil now that Lula is back. Circumstances have changed since his first presidency, a political crisis, high inflation, a struggling economy, and infrastructure deficits beset the country. And this is bad news for Portuguese-speaking countries, which have always been particularly close to the Southern African, Southern American nation. For example, Brazil was the first country to recognize Angolan independence in 1975. Since then, around 80 bilateral agreements have been signed, pushing investments. As a result, Angola is likely to remain one of Brazil's largest trading partners on the continent. But that bilateral relationship is not without flaws. Brazilian companies, especially in the diamond and oil sectors, have been involved in blatant corruption. For example, in 2017, engineering conglomerate Odebrecht admitted to a New York court that it had paid $50 million in bribes to secure contracts in Angola and Mozambique. Odebrecht was at one time Angola's largest private sector employer. Some analysts hope that due to his troubles with corruption accusations, which landed him in jail before the Supreme Court annulled the sentence, Lula da Silva will now pay more attention to the dealings of Brazilian businesses abroad. Angolan researcher and activist Rafael Marquez expressed doubts, quote, relations between Angola and Brazil will become more transparent only Brazilian and Angolan governments become less corrupt, and the countries have functional institutions, especially a functional judicial system. Mozambicans are even warier of their Lusophone ally. Up to 2014, and before being superseded by China, Brazil was the country's leading trading partner. But Brazilian investments in Maputo, the capital of Mozambique, have also been beset by corruption and failure. As a result, mining giant Vale abandoned the country in 2021. pulling out Brazil's biggest investment in Africa. Mozambique is still in the grip of a major financial scandal that involved Odebrecht and came to light during the investigations that culminated in Lula da Silva's arrest. Activist Fatima Mimbiri hopes that Lula da Silva's return to power will help clarify the case. But, quote, if he has any connection to this scandal, and if there is no independence of the Brazilian and Mozambican justice systems, quote, he might do precisely the opposite, she advised. Africa's history is linked to Brazil since the 16th century when the Portuguese brought millions of slaves over from their African colonies. As a result, more than 50% of Brazil's population is descended from Africans. Irene Vida Gala, a Brazilian diplomat specializing in relations with Africa, sees plenty of room for future partnerships. Among the most important common interests are the environment, the protection of tropical forests like the Amazon and Congo forests, biodiversity, sustainable exploration of mineral resources, and in the fight against poverty and inequality, she said. Brazil has much to offer, like technology in the area of agricultural production and food security, agricultural financing, and the industrialization of the food chain. Brazilian critics of stronger ties with Africa point to past corruption scandals and human rights problems in some African countries. Karine de Souza Silva of the University of Santa Catarina said concerns by human rights movements were legitimate. But she also pointed to a minority that preferred to build relations with, quote, white, end quote, countries to the detriment of nations in the Southern Hemisphere. And this colonial conception that Africa is a poorer continent that has nothing to offer is mistaken. It is racist. So these are some of the important things that we need to know. And in case you don't know, this is what's pertinent on the world stage, and we don't often know that. This is something that you may find very interesting as well. A look at the German-made Leopard 2 tank. Ukraine's foreign and defense ministers have appealed to their Western allies to step up arms deliveries considerably and send advanced Leopard battle tanks. So why there is so much focus on the Leopard 2? And that's going to be something that we're going to need to explore a little bit further. And that's what we're going to do. I didn't realize I must have left that program to the side. So we'll have to cover that hopefully tomorrow. Bear with me a second here. Okay, one second. One second here. I wanted to go and cover a couple of other things here with you. Bear with me a moment. Okay. Whoops, I don't know how that came about. Okay. This is really quite interesting because I'm going to be 73 in about another week and a half. Well, not really, actually in a full week. So I don't know, I guess as a worker, this has become very pertinent. France is hit by strikes and protests as unions are fighting Macron's pension overhaul. Well, a day of strikes and protests has kicked off in France with transport, schools, and refinery shipments disrupted as workers walk off their jobs in an attempt to derail President Emmanuel Macron's unpopular pension overhaul. And It seems that police have already arrested 20 people on the sidelines of the protest in Paris, French daily Le Monde reports, whose reporter Pierre Bouvier also says that officers have used tear gas to try to calm the situation down. According to Agence France-Presse, members of the anarchist Black Bloc movement have thrown rubbish bins, bottles, and smoke bombs at police. In the tweet, officers can be seen running on the boulevard Beaumarchais near the Bastille in central Paris. French President Emmanuel Macron, who's in Spain today, did not seem to be buoyed by the massive protests back home, telling a press conference in Madrid that the reform is just and responsible and that France must carry this out. Well, Macron urged the French to demonstrate peacefully and to avoid any violence or vandalism. Well, the French workers' strike over the government's pension reform has temporarily halted ferry crossings between Dover and Calais, crossing the major sea route for trade between Britain and the continent. The port of Dover said it had suspended services to Calais from 8 a.m. and that loading was only expected to resume in the afternoon. Freight traffic on the British side has been contained within the ferry terminal and the port of Dover added. The P&O said it hopes its first service would leave Dover at about 3 in the afternoon, while the first ferry out of Calais was expected to depart at 5. Marie, a PhD student in sociology, is also attending the Paris rally and says she's protesting because this reform is unfair and targets the poorest and women. It will increase inequalities and isn't adapted to the way we work nowadays. We are more and more productive, so it doesn't make sense to work longer, she told a reporter at the scene at Place de la République. Well, Maxime, a 24-year-old prison guard who has joined the protest in Paris, says that pushing back the retirement age for his line of work is unreasonable, quote unquote. Being a prison guard is a tiring job. In Fleury, which is a prison, we can be confronted with young and violent prisoners. It's not possible to do that after 60. And more than 38,000 people have taken to the streets to join the anti-reform protests in Lyon, France's third largest city. The daily newspaper Le Monde reports, citing a union estimate. At least one car has been set alight on the sidelines of the protest in Rennes in western France, reported the newspaper Ouest France. Which means West France reports, and video footage in a tweet shows a Tesla ablaze as protesters are walking nearby. Well, tens of thousands of people have gathered at Paris's cathedral, central Place de la République, to take part in the protest against the reform, and so that's a problem. The challenge for unions, which are far less powerful in France than they used to be, is whether they can transform popular opposition to the reform and anger with the cost of living crisis into a mass social protest that will last beyond today and eventually get the government to backtrack. Well, strike action has forced the cancellation of most trains around France, including some international connections, according to the SNCF Rail Authority. Air travel is less affected, with about 20% of flights out of Paris or the airport canceled and airlines warnings of delay. Polls show a large majority of the French oppose Macron's planned pension overhaul, but support for strike action risks are fizzling out as the public grapples with disruptions. So polls show a majority of the French oppose the pension reforms, and analysts say maintaining public support for strikes will be crucial to unions' chances of forcing a U-turn. And the question is, could the strikes force Macron to back down? Well, French Labor Minister Olivier Dussopt has acknowledged concerns prompted by the pension plans that will require from workers an additional collective effort, while calling on strikers not to block the economy of the country. The right to strike is a freedom, but we did not want any blockades, he said, speaking to LCI television. But for Philippe Martinez, the head of the hard left CGT union, the sacrifices demanded are profoundly unfair. It's rare for French unions to all agree on something, so it demonstrates the seriousness of the issues, Martinez had said. So turns out that more than 200 rallies are expected around France, including a large one in Paris involving all of France's unions in a rare display of unity. Opponents of the pension reform are hoping to draw more than 1 million protesters in a show of strength, with further protests expected in the coming days. So we'll have to see where that is. Just saw something pass by on the website. Bear with me a moment. Let me just see. This came through. Bear with me a second here. Let me just see if I have this. One moment here. Okay, it's not here. Maybe it's here. One second. One moment. Where is this? I could have sworn I just saw something, you know, come through on the internet, and I don't know where it is. Bear with me a second, because it must be here someplace, and I just can't seem to somehow find it. Okay, it's not here. There's some other place here, maybe. Hold on a minute. Maybe it's in here. Okay. Where could it be? Maybe it's here. Nope. Okay. I've got to see this because it seems somebody has just been charged with manslaughter. I don't remember. Bear with me a second. Let me see if I can find this news item. Bear with me a second here. One second. Let me see if we can get this. All right, this is not coming up for some reason. Okay. I guess I can't find it for some reason, and I can't understand why, but might as well give up because I don't want to bore you guys to death while I'm trying to find this here. Hunting around team, the Powerball ticket worth $50,000 has been purchased in the Hudson Valley. Well, that's nice. So good luck to them, that's for sure. All right. Okay. Don't see it here. No matter how I'm looking at so many different things, and I can't seem to find anything here about this. I think this was a situation where an actor accidentally shot somebody, not realizing that the gun he was holding was loaded. It was not supposed to be loaded. It was supposed to be some sort of item that they use on a movie or a film, and I don't remember the term that was used, but there's been a charge against him of some sort, and I don't know what that means at the end of the day or how that's going to be found out. All right, well, let me just cover a couple of other things with you, because for some reason this is not working out. And 1 second. Well, this is really important because we're talking about the debt ceiling. Seems that these are some of the things you should know about the threat of a default that is looming. The clock's now ticking to prevent a financial crisis, and the U.S. hit its debt ceiling on Thursday today, triggering the Treasury Department to start taking extraordinary measures to prevent a default. So while Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen doesn't expect the United States to default on its debt before early June, Congress has to get serious about negotiating a solution, which is not expected to be easy, and here's what the situation is all about. But first, what is a debt ceiling? Established by Congress, a debt ceiling is the maximum amount the federal government is able to borrow to finance obligations that lawmakers and presidents have already approved. Since the government runs budget deficits and the revenue it collects is not sufficient, increasing the cap does not authorize new spending commitments. The debt ceiling, which currently stands at $31.4 trillion, was created more than a century ago and has been modified more than 100 times since World War II. It was originally designed to make it easier for the federal government to borrow. The limit, here it is, Alex Baldwin, there it is, Alex Baldwin, prosecutors in New Mexico announced Thursday that actor and producer Alec Baldwin is being charged with involuntary manslaughter in the deadly 2021 shooting on the set of the Western film Rust. The armorer who oversaw firearms on the set, Hannah Gutierrez-Reed, is also being charged with involuntary manslaughter. Baldwin was holding a gun during a rehearsal when it discharged, killing cinematographer Halina Hutchins. She was wounded by a gunshot during setup for a scene at the ranch on the outskirts of Santa Fe on October 21 of 2021, and Baldwin was pointing a pistol at Hutchins when the gun went off, killing her and wounding the director, Joel Souza. Santa Fe County Sheriff Adam Mendoza, who led the initial investigation into Hutchins' death, described, quote, a degree of neglect, end quote, on the film set, but he left decisions about potential criminal charges to prosecutors after delivering the result of the year-long investigation in October. And that report didn't specify how live ammunition wound up on the film set. Taking control of the investigation, Carmack Altwies was granted an emergency $300,000 request for the state to pay for a special prosecutor, special investigator, and other experts and personnel. Baldwin, known for his roles in 30 Rock and The Hunt for Red October and his impression of former President Donald Trump on Saturday Night Live, has described the killing of Hutchins as a tragic accident. He has sought to clear his name by suing people involved in handling and supplying the loaded gun that was handed to him on the set. Baldwin, also a co-producer on Rust, said he was told the gun was safe. In his lawsuit, Baldwin said that while working on camera angles with Hutchins during rehearsal for a scene, he pointed the gun in her direction and pulled back and released the hammer on the gun, which discharged. New Mexico's Office of the Medical Investigator determined the shooting was an accident following the completion of an autopsy and a review of law enforcement reports. Well, New Mexico's Occupational Health and Safety Bureau has levied the maximum fine against Rust Movie Productions based on a scathing narrative of safety failures, including testimony that production managers took limited or no action to address two misfires of blank ammunition on set prior to the fatal shooting. Well, Rust Movie Productions continues to challenge the basis of a $137,000 fine by regulators who say production managers on the set failed to follow standard industry protocols for firearm safety. The armorer, Gutierrez-Reed, has been the subject of much of the scrutiny in the case, along with an independent ammunition supplier. An attorney for Gutierrez-Reed has said the armorer didn't put a live round in the gun that killed Hutchins and believes he was the victim of sabotage. Authorities said they found no evidence of that. Investigators initially found 500 rounds of ammunition at the movie set on the outskirts of Santa Fe, a mix of blanks, dummy rounds, and what appeared to be live rounds. Industry experts have said that live rounds should never be on the set. In April of 2022, the Santa Fe Sheriff's Department released a trove of files, including lapel camera videos of the mortally wounded Hutchins slipping in and out of consciousness as an evacuation helicopter arrived, witness interrogations, email threads, text conversations, and inventories of ammunition, and hundreds of photographs rounded out of that collection of evidence. State workplace safety regulators said that immediate gun safety concerns were addressed when Rust ceased filming, and that a return to filming in New Mexico would be accompanied by new safety inspections. The family of Hutchins, widower Matthew Hutchins and son Andros, settled a lawsuit against producers under an agreement that aims to restart filming with Matthew's involvement as executive producer. Rust was beset by disputes from the start in early October of 2021. Seven crew members walked off the set just hours before the fatal shooting amid discord over working conditions. Hutchins' death has influenced negotiations over safety provisions in film crew union contracts with Hollywood producers and spurred other filmmakers to choose computer-generated imagery on gunfire rather than real weapons, blank ammunition, to minimize risks. Wow. So, and let's quickly look, since we're talking about people in music industry and so far and so on and so forth. So, 1 second. Okay. Well, Lisa Marie Presley's cause of death has been deferred, a coroner says. Cause of Lisa Marie Presley's death remains unknown, according to a Los Angeles County Medical Examiner coroner. The star died earlier this month after being rushed to a hospital from her Calabasas home after experiencing cardiac arrest. The medical examiner has not been able to determine the cause of death, and it was deferred. That means that the cause of death has not been determined and the medical examiner is requesting more investigation into the death and additional studies, a spokesperson for the medical examiner's coroner's office said. After additional testing, a doctor will evaluate the case again, but there is no time for when that could happen, the spokesperson said. So it was on January 12th, Presley's mom, Priscilla, posted on Facebook that her daughter was rushed to the hospital. Quote, please keep her and our family in your prayers. We feel the prayers from around the world and ask for privacy during this time, Priscilla had written. Well, shortly after Priscilla's initial post, her publicist put out a statement about her daughter's death. Priscilla Presley and the Presley family are shocked and devastated by the tragic death of their beloved Lisa Marie, statement had read. Quote, they are profoundly grateful for the support, love, and prayers of everyone and ask for privacy during this very difficult time, end quote. Next day was announced that Presley will be buried at Graceland, Elvis's former home in Memphis that has been turned into a museum. Fans left flowers and signs outside the home's gates to honor Presley after her death was announced. Elvis is buried on the grounds, as is Presley's son, Benjamin Keough, who died in 2020. She will be buried next to him. Elvis died when Lisa, his only child, was just 9 years old. In her final post before her death, Presley shared an essay on grief she penned for People, in which she wrote about the difficulty of losing her son who died by suicide. I've dealt with death, grief, and loss since the age of 9 years old, she wrote. I've had more than anyone's fair share of it in my lifetime, and somehow I've made it this far. Presley, a singer-songwriter, shared Benjamin and a daughter, Riley, 33, with her first husband, Danny Keough, and has 14 year old twins, Harper Vivienne and Finley Aaron, with Michael Lockwood, her music producer. She was married 4 times to Q, Michael Jackson, Nicolas Cage, and Lockwood. Ah, what a tragedy. Unbelievable. Literally unbelievable. These singers, tragedy of life, unbelievable. Literally unbelievable. Okay, bear with me a second as we move back to where we should have been. Okay. All right, so where were we? So what happens if the United States defaults on its debt? It is unlikely that the government will exhaust its cash and the extraordinary measures before early June, though there is considerable uncertainty around that forecast, Yellen wrote in a letter to House Speaker Kevin McCarthy last week. Depends in part on how much 2022 tax revenue the government collects this spring. If the government is no longer able to borrow, it would not have enough money to pay all its bills in full and on time, including interest on the national debt. So it would likely have to temporarily delay payments or default on some of its commitments, potentially affecting Social Security payments, veterans benefits, and federal employees' salaries, among others. But no one knows exactly how the Treasury would handle the situation, since it has never happened before. A default would also wreak havoc on the U.S. economy and the global financial markets, as well as raise borrowing costs. Even the threat of one in 2011 caused the only credit rating downgrade in the nation's history. So these moves are mainly behind-the-scenes accounting maneuvers. Treasury secretaries are authorized by Congress to take several steps of extraordinary measures to prevent a default, giving lawmakers more time to increase or suspend the limit. And secretaries in both Democratic and Republican administrations have taken such steps. This time, Yellen anticipates selling existing investments and suspending reinvestment of the Civil Service Retirement and Disability Fund and the Postal Service Retiree Health Benefits Fund. Also, to suspending the reinstatement of the Government Securities Fund of the Federal Employees Retirement System in the House Speaker election has raised concern about whether McCarthy will be able to corral Republican headliners who see a potential default as a way to force the government to cut back spending and negotiate a deal with Democrats who oppose any reductions. McCarthy said on Fox on Sunday that now is a good time to look, quote, look at the places that we can change our behavior, end quote, because, quote, what we're going to do is bankrupt this country, end quote. But the White House last week said it would not offer any concessions or negotiate on raising the debt ceiling. Meanwhile, House Republicans are preparing contingency plans that would tell the Treasury Department which payments to prioritize if lawmakers can't agree to address the debt ceiling. So while the two are often confused, a government shutdown happens when Congress doesn't pass a federal funding bill, while a debt ceiling crisis would occur if lawmakers don't approve legislation to lift the debt limit. Congress passed a $1.7 trillion federal spending bill last month, avoiding a government shutdown that could have caused non-essential operations to cease and could have left many federal employees without pay. Legislation will fund government operations at the end of the year on September 30. And so we'll have to see where all of this goes, but this is a looming crisis, that's for sure. And we'll see how the Republicans and how the Democrats and the Republicans figure this stuff out, because it's going to become a major, major problem, which is fascinating. Let's quickly look at this, because I think you'll find this fascinating. The New Zealand Prime Minister, her name is Jacinda Ardern, says she will resign as she cites burnout. Ardern, who has become a global progressive icon since taking power in 2017, said she no longer had, quote, enough in the tank, end quote, to do justice to the job and would step down by February 7th. The New Zealand Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern, announced on Thursday that she will step down, saying she no longer had, quote, enough in the tank, end quote, after a premiership defined by her response to a series of crises. Ardern, who's 42, has become a global progressive icon since her election in 2017 and won praise for her handling of the nation's worst mass shooting and the beginning of the pandemic. But her approval ratings have plummeted at home, jeopardizing her re-election prospects and intensifying the vitriolic abuse she has experienced throughout her time in office. With such a privileged role comes responsibility, the responsibility to know when you are the right person to lead, and also when you're not, Ardern said in a surprise announcement in Napier, where her governing center-left Labor Party is holding a caucus retreat. Quote, I know that this job takes, and I know that I no longer have enough in the tank to do it justice, end quote. She said she would resign as prime minister no later than February 7 and would not seek re-election to parliament later this year. Quote, this has been the most fulfilling 5.5 years of my life, but it has also had its challenges, end quote, Ardern told reporters. Continuing, she says, among an agenda focused on housing, child poverty, and climate change, we encountered a major biosecurity incursion, a domestic terror event, a major natural disaster, a global pandemic, and an economic crisis. Quote, the decision that have had to be made have been continual and they have been weighty, she said. Ardern, who was the world's youngest female leader when she first took office, has faced a number of challenges, including the mass shooting at two mosques in Christchurch, the capital, that killed 51 people, a deadly volcanic eruption, an outbreak of cattle disease, and the coronavirus. And her international reputation in many ways has been made out of dealings with things that no one would have wanted, said Grant Duncan, an associate professor at Massey University in Auckland. Ardern was praised for her, quote, zero COVID, end quote, approach to the pandemic and the managed transition away from it once vaccines became available, allowing life inside the country to continue largely as normal while minimizing deaths. She was a highly visible face of New Zealand's pandemic response, urging the country's, quote, team of 5 million people to face the crisis together at near daily public briefings. COVID-19 in particular really sorted the sheep from the goats when it came to a leadership around the world, Duncan had said. Though Ardern's pandemic strategy helped propel her party to a historic landslide win in 2020, it also drew criticism that it was too strict, with the entire nation going into lockdown in August of 2021. And the discovery of this, after the discovery of a single case, an official inquiry into the government's response is underway, and many of Ardern's right-wing critics cheered her resignation announcement on Thursday. Labor Party will hold a vote for a new leader on Sunday. If that person receives more than two-thirds of caucus support, Ardern said, she will resign soon after and the new leader will be sworn in as prime minister. Otherwise, the vote will go to the wider party membership. Ardern said she plans to remain in parliament until April, avoiding the need for a snap vote in her suburban Auckland electorate. Beyond that, she said, she has no plans other than spending time with her family. Ardern was the world's second elected head of government to give birth while in office, bringing her three-month-old daughter, Nevs, to the floor of the United Nations General Assembly in New York in 2018. So in her remarks on Thursday, Ardern said that her partner, television presenter Clark Gayford, whose wedding to Arden was postponed by the pandemic, and Nevi were the ones that have sacrificed the most out of all of us, she said. To Nevi, Mom is looking forward to being there when you start school this year, she said. And to Clark, let's finally get married, end quote. Ardern had faced the prospect of a tough campaign in the next election, which she said Thursday would be held October 14. Along with a perceived increase in violent crime, New Zealand is facing many of the same issues as other countries, including a housing crisis, income inequality, and surging inflation. Though recent polls have put Labor behind the Conservative National Party, Ardern said she had not that had not affected her decision. I'm not leaving because I believe we can't win the election, but because I believe we can and will, and we will need a fresh set of shoulders for that challenge, she said. The tributes to Ardern have poured in from New Zealand politicians and leaders around the world. Jacinda Ardern has shown the world how to lead with intellect and strength, Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese said on Twitter. She has demonstrated that empathy and insight are powerful leadership qualities. Christopher Luxon, head of the opposition National Party, said that Ardern had made a significant contribution to the country and was a strong ambassador for New Zealand on the world stage. Her leadership, he said, in the aftermath of the Christchurch terror attacks was simultaneously strong and compassionate and something she can be proud of. Well, former New Zealand Prime Minister Helen Clark said Ardern had done an extraordinary job, quote unquote, and lamented her rising threats she has faced from far-right groups that have embraced vaccine misinformation and extremism. The pressure on prime ministers are always great, but in this era of social media, clickbait, and 24/7 media cycles, Jacinda has faced a level of hatred and vitriol which, in my experience, is unprecedented in our country, she said. Ardern said on Thursday that while the heightened security risk, quote, does have an impact, end quote, it was not the reason for her resignation. She said she hoped that New Zealanders would remember her as someone who always tried to be kind, end quote. She said she hoped to leave behind a belief that you can be kind, but strong, but decisive, optimistic, but focused, and that you can be your own kind of leader, one that knows when it's time to go. Unbelievable. She really did place New Zealand on the map. I don't think without her, it would never have come about. Really, truly fascinating, to say the least. Okay, let's just quickly look to see what else we can share with you. Bear with me a moment. One second. All right, let me just see if we can get here. Okay. Okay. Now, let me just quickly look here. One second. Yeah, this is what I wanted. Well, let's first go to Mexico and then we'll go to Israel. The Mexican president says that his government will consider El Chapo's return request. Mexico's president said on Wednesday that his government will consider a plea by imprisoned drug lord Joaquin El Chapo Guzman to be returned to Mexico, presumably to serve out a sentence. Guzman was 64. was sentenced to life behind bars in the United States for a drug conspiracy that spread murder and mayhem for more than two decades. Guzman was or has lived in poor conditions in prison since his 2019 conviction, said Jose Refugio Rodriguez, a Mexican lawyer who claims to represent him. And Rodriguez told local media that Guzman hasn't had adequate access to sunlight, visits, good food, or medical care. The Mexican embassy in Washington said in its Twitter account that it had received an email from Rodriguez about the issue and had turned it over to Mexico's Foreign Relations Department. President Andrés Manuel López Obrador, affectionately known as AMLO, A-M-L-O, said we will review it, adding, quote, you always have to keep the door open when it comes to human rights, end quote. The United States and Mexico have a prison transfer agreement that allows inmates convicted in one country to serve out their sentence in their home country under certain circumstances. But given Guzman's crimes, his sentence, and the risks he purportedly still poses, many doubt the agreement would apply in this case. So we'll have to see where all that goes. Now, let's look at what's happening here in the Middle East, in Israel specifically. There's a setback for Israel's Netanyahu as the Supreme Court orders him to fire a minister. Israel's Supreme Court ordered Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on Wednesday to remove a senior minister over a past tax fraud conviction in a setback for the new right-wing coalition government. The 10-1 ruling on Shas party leader Aryeh Deri looks likely to further stoke tensions between the cabinet and Israel's Supreme Court over government reform plans which aim to rein in the top court. Most of the judges have determined that this appointment is extremely unreasonable, and thus the prime minister must remove Deri from office, said a court summary of the ruling. Now, Deri, who holds the interior and health portfolios and is due to become finance minister under a rotation deal, confessed to tax fraud last year in a plea deal that spared him jail time. Well, some of the judges in their ruling also cited Deri having previously told the magistrate's court dealing with his tax case that he would be retiring from politics. There was no immediate response on Wednesday to the ruling from Netanyahu, who returned to office in December at the head of a hard right government. The justice minister and fellow Likud party member Yariv Levin said that the bench had chosen not to respect the people's choice. I will do whatever is necessary to fully protect their crisis. All right. So I think that's the story there. All right. So what we're going to do is we're going to close down the our broadcast with you today, and hopefully we'll see you tomorrow on the air, and we'll go from there. So be well, and thank you for being with us. Always a pleasure. Goodbye. Where are we here? We're going to end the episode.